Hey, welcome to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. Delighted to have you with us. We're going to have a very special show today. We typically follow the money. In this case, we're following some people who may be following your money. And that is talking about the great OPM hack of 2015, or the great Office of Personnel Management hacks of 2015. My guest is Jill Arturo. She is the brand new editor of Federal Times. Jill, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, congratulations. Where did you come from?
I ran the FedBiz product over at Washington Business Journal immediately before here, so focused a lot on federal contracting and procurement. And prior to that, I was a government executive. So I've been in and around federal workforce for some time.
Well, good for you. So you could tell some more stories, too, about the various things. You know, I noticed this week in Federal Times, you have a feature about the great OPM hack.
Yeah.
And this is, I get, you know, often in this beat, we cover the same stories over and over and over.
Mm-hmm.
There was a significant hack of the Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board, the TSP, couple of years back, and it raised people's awareness and hackles and created some fears. As far as we know, nothing serious came of it, at least so far, but the information is still out there. This one is so big, it's hard to know where to start, depending on, I guess, which... What are the numbers you're hearing?
It's really just in and around a little more, really, than 21 million records were stolen over the course of two breaches altogether. So those are all personnel records. A lot of them had to do with folks applying for clearances. So that introduces a lot of sensitive information that even goes beyond your typical Social Security number, address, that sort of thing.
Well, that's true, and the mother's maiden name is involved in this, and of course that's a key part of many passwords or code words,
yeah.
And they're always asking you that. By the way, hacker thieves, I do not give my mother's maiden name, so
yeah.
I haven't for some time, but you just have to give a name that you're going to be able to remember. We've had all kinds of hacks in the past, and I think the average person such as you or me or our listeners would be appalled to find out how many hack attempts there are made every day against the government, and,
mm-hmm.
and I'm sure you guys, there have been hack attempts, Federal Times, because your name is Federal. We have had the same problem, Federal News Radio, hack attacks. But this one, the scope of it is just almost breathtaking. If you figure that the average the U.S. population is, what, 320 million, something like that. If you've got 22 million people that were hacked, that's you or your neighbor or your uncle or somebody you know.
Yeah, not to mention a lot of what's amazing as well is folks put in this information that was taken, they include information about their neighbors, folks that are giving them references, that are references for the clearance background investigation. So it extended to family members of federal workforce. It extended to neighbors, friends. So it really did just...
That's amazing. I had not thought of that. But of course, I remember when I was young, just starting out, a civil service in those days investigator and Army investigators would come around to see me. I was still in the reserves, but they'd come around to see me about friends of mine who were applying for federal
mm-hmm.
jobs or something to do with the Army. And after a while, I got to know this one investigator, and I said to him, you know, after maybe his 10th visit to me to vet somebody, I said, "Isn't it kind of silly? Somebody gives you my name, obviously their friend. They trust me, and yet you're sent around to investigate them." And I said, "What could you possibly find that's, you know, detrimental?" And he said, "You'd be surprised what your friends say about you." Oh, really?
That's true. I mean, I had two requests in the last couple weeks of people, even as the process right now is kind of being looked at. They shut the system down temporarily in terms of the background checks. But I had an investigator come for two of my neighbors. So it's amazing, how extensive it goes. And folks are... you know, have biometric information was in these systems, fingerprints. It really kind of extends beyond what we hear about even for something like the Target breach and so forth.
Yeah.
It is pretty unprecedented.
This is serious stuff. And I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, that some of the information they got is on people who had never worked for the government but maybe applied for government jobs.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So that's a huge group right there.
Yeah.
You know, you can say, well, I never worked for the government, didn't get the job. But if you applied, your information may be in there.
Your info is in the database. I had someone reach out to me that was actually a subcontractor, which technically they're not working for the government, but mm-hmm. they were working for a systems integrator, and therefore they needed. And in that case, it was the minimal clearance, you know, the lowest level. And yet even that, you know, you still give a lot of personal information out. Even that was taken.
Well, and I gather, too, when you go for one of these top secret or sonic or whatever they call them, that you have to confess all. If you have a bizarre habit or fetish or something like that, you're supposed to tell them.
Yeah.
And then that too, is in the breach, as it were.
It is. It is. Lots of personal information, medical history. It's pretty amazing what got out.
Well, I was trying to get the numbers accurate in my head the other day, but of all the government workers that I know that I've talked to lately, and of all the government retirees I've known that I've talked to lately, it seems like about half of them have been contacted by OPM, and the other half have not heard anything yet. Does that mean anything?
Well, you know what they're doing is because there were two breaches, keep in mind, and the first one was pretty modest. It was a little over $4 million. All of those individuals have been contacted. But the second breach is what, you know, there was some overlap there, but got us to the nearly $22 million. They have not, as of yet, OPM has not awarded a contract for a person to do fraud detection for that breach. So folks might not have gotten contacted yet because a contract is in place. And then the way they always do it is they do a phased approach, even once they do have somebody to kind of monitor people's credit and so forth. Because if they let all 20 million people know at once, then it's going to just the hotline's going to be bombarded and so forth. So they will do it in a phased approach. But a lot of people are also wondering when a contract is actually going to be awarded to ensure folks have the credit monitoring they need, because that has not happened yet.
Well, I've had people ask about this credit monitoring, and of course, I think the government started out at 18 months, then 3 years came into mm-hmm. play, and now some of the unions and NARF and those groups are demanding credit monitoring for life.
Yeah.
I mean, their argument is, what if they sell this to some bad guys in Ukraine or somewhere? What if they sell it 4 or 5 years from now?
And
the problem hops up. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly makes sense to me. I mean, people, the time factor is almost irrelevant because this information is out there and can be used not only once, but in theory, multiple times, depending on how it circulates in terms of the criminal side of things. So I could understand the desire, and again, this isn't someone just tapping into a retail store. This is someone that has massive amount of information. So certainly I understand the call. Whether or not, you know, the government will provide that is unknown, but they're certainly getting the pressure for it.
I know we are understandably outraged here in the U.S., in Washington, about this breach, but I saw an interview with the former head of both the NSA and the CIA, and you know, he's a consummate professional, and he said he's not endorsing it, not condoning it, but he's saying this is a legitimate intelligence target. And he said, if I had had a chance to get the similar information from the Chinese government or any other, I would have jumped at it.
Yeah, frightening. And what's interesting is, you know, we did an interview with Joe Ross, who is the president and co-founder of CSID. That's a company that is providing fraud prevention for that initial 4.2 million folks that were hacked. And what's interesting, I mean, identity fraud is a huge concern, and rightfully so, and federal workers are certainly concerned about that, as they should be. But really, you know, the fact that unofficially, I suppose, people are saying it was China that mm-hmm. perpetuated or took on this breach in the first place. They're not after stealing identities. That's really not the goal. It is much more, you know, gaining access to more government systems, and they're going to use personnel information to try to crack the code for logging in to those systems and digging deeper and deeper into the government systems, often undetected. So that's really where where the concern takes on a different level. It's not to say we should minimize identity fraud, because that's a very real concern. And who knows what they'll do with this information? Maybe they'll sell it as well. But in terms of the goals of a country like China, it's espionage. It's not identity fraud.
Right. Hey, Jill, let's break right there, and we'll come back in a minute. I'm talking with Jill LaToro. She's with the Federal Times editor, and we're going to be right back here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, talking with Jill LaToro. She is editor of the Federal Times, and she has an excellent story this week about the OPM data breach that took place last year, and we learned about it this year. Jill, we were talking about everybody, we always want to do the who, what, when, and where, but the real question most of the time is why. Mm-hmm. Something. And in this case, assuming it is, as our government has strongly hinted, it is the Chinese government, then as you said before the break, they're probably not looking to get into our credit card information and charge things for us. They're looking for what they call it, HumeNet, but human network intelligence. Mm-hmm. About, how old you are, what kind of debts, you're having marital problems, do you have a particular fetish, that sort of thing. Something that could be used to recruit or possibly blackmail somebody, a federal worker in a critical position. And I was reading a little bit on the Chinese intelligence services, and they have several, as we do, but it said they, unlike many other countries where we will plant sleepers or plant agents. So the Chinese, up to now at least, often depend on students, travelers, visiting professors, that sort of thing. And they're in the U.S. for a relatively short period of time, but they make contacts that way. Is that your understanding?
There's so many ways the information can be used, which is a little frightening. Yes, I've heard that. I've also heard that a lot of this is going to come down to social engineering, that they're going to take all of this massive amount of information. They're going to then go into social networks. They're going to figure out, take these federal employees, track them in a Facebook, figure out who their daughter's name is, figure out the maiden name, as we mentioned, figure out where they went to high school and what their mascot is. All of those are the basis of so many security questions, and that allows them, and it's amazing how they can do this, but it has been done in the past. It allows them to figure out login information and, get into sensitive systems on the government side. So, and then also, as you mentioned, recruiting folks, getting at the personal information that kind of leaves people vulnerable to influence and other factors. So there's so many directions that they can do this. And in terms of a foreign government tapping into the U.S., I've also heard that they're maintaining massive databases of U.S. citizens, information about U.S. citizens that they can utilize in any number of ways, blackmailing to get information about the government and otherwise. So it's a tactic, and it's hard to know exactly what they're doing, but there's many, many approaches that are pretty frightening.
Well, you mentioned the magic word of Facebook there, and I think people of a certain age, and that would include me, are sometimes horrified at what we see on Facebook. You may be hurt that the person didn't tell you directly, but they're announcing to the world that they're getting divorced.
Yeah.
or some such thing. But this Facebook thing is, we're leaving the key to the house outside on the front step.
Yep. We certainly are. We certainly are. And people are very trusting on social networks, whether it be Facebook or Twitter. It's amazing the stories you hear of people getting approached through social networks by complete strangers. And if those strangers have a little bit of personal information, if they can garner trust from other people who are perhaps a little bit more on the vulnerable side or naive side, that's frightening too. because, again, it provides access to information in the U.S., and that's the goal in this case.
Well, you know, among the many reasons you listed that they may have done this or things they may do with this information, I went to Guantanamo Bay in 2007. And it was, you know, still up and going. It was a fully operational detainee facility, and got the tour and all that. And the guards took a number of precautions. Many of them wore faceplates because the detainees were spitting on them and doing various things. But they also, many of them wore fake identification badges. So one would say, and I'm making this up, but one would say something like Mickey Mouse rather than the name. And they said the reason for that, it wasn't to torment people or be silly, but it was if the inmates could learn your name, they could track you down and maybe have somebody do harm to your family. So there's all this potential anytime any of your private information gets in the wrong hands.
True. And that's, you know, again, we hear about identity theft, but I think federal employees and those outside the federal workforce that were impacted by this, I think there's an education that's gradually happening where they are learning that this goes well beyond people opening credit cards in their name, that their information has a potential of being used on so many ways. And that, I mean, in some ways that you feel like you're being put in danger or certainly in a vulnerable position. And, you know, that's pretty frightening.
Well, you know, sometimes too, the purpose of an intelligence operation is not necessarily to kill or maim or even do any destruction. It's to undermine people's morale and undermine their confidence in government. And I know of one particular operation that was targeted against a small country, or at least the concept of it was. And one of the things was, this was back in the day when there were payphones. Fairly poor country, so very few people had a private phone, but there were payphones on the street. And part of the plan was to just go around and clip the receiver off the phone, and to flood the country with counterfeit money, and do things that would frustrate people, make for long lines at the bank, and make it impossible to make phone calls. And in a case like this, we're assuming this is the Chinese government, and they want it for intelligence purposes. But somewhere down the line, just in order to cause chaos, if they sold or gave this to some sophisticated hackers, they in turn might be able to destroy or mess up the credit records of 10, 20 million people.
Oh, yeah. And you can't ignore that. That's a very real possibility. And you mentioned trust. I mean, I got a note from someone who said, you know, who was just beside himself and angry at the federal government for not having the systems locked down appropriately. And in his words, he said, you know what, when I give my information at a retail store, you know, you expect that this could happen. He said, I give it to the Homeland Security Department. I don't expect this could happen, because in this case, it was for a clearance with DHS. So, and that's, you know, it's true. It kind of wears down the trust in terms of the federal workforce and our own government. And that's not to say this can't happen to anybody, because the reality is they know how to get in. So, you know, we needed more security in place, but it's not a shock that they figured out a way around what we have. But, I mean, deteriorating trust in terms of the workforce especially is a real concern for the federal government. They're having a hard enough time recruiting people now.
Yeah, well, Jill, I talked to a lady who is in the business of solving problems. She does this professionally, but she, you know, she's a fraud buster and that sort of thing. And she said this insurance that people get for in case you're hacked is supposed to make you whole. She said it's not that good. And other people have said that at what the service provides, they'll say, yeah, you were hacked. That's really terrible.
Yeah.
And then that's sort of the end of it. And if people are expecting that somehow or other this service will protect them from everything, they may have another thing coming. Is that right?
It's actually, part of the problem is also that it's confusing. The actual services that are being provided to the federal workers are confusing. We did a whole story on how folks didn't understand whether they qualified. They didn't understand whether they were covered. They also can't get access. They couldn't at the time get access to the name of the insurance provider that was actually providing the insurance. So it was just there was a lot of lack of clarity in terms of what the coverage actually included. I mean, you know, it's like any insurance policy. There's always the fine print in terms of what is and isn't covered. So it's hard to know. And so far, there have been no breaches reported from those that are monitoring it, or no actual fraud detected. Mm-hmm. But once it is, I think we're going to find out a whole bunch of more information in terms of whether or not those federal employees are getting properly covered. Like you said, it's one thing to say, yes, we see a red flag.
Mm-hmm. Then what? Yeah.
But then what? You know, it's often, and not just from the government. In these cases, it's often left to the victim to then chase it down and figure out what to do about it, call their bank. Some banks are better than others. So, you know, that is definitely a challenge.
Well, and I would think, too, that, you know, if you have a company that maybe covers 6 million people or 12 million people, it's doable and they can do whatever they can do.
Mm-hmm.
But if you suddenly get 22 million red alerts.
Yeah.
How would they possibly be able to handle that? And again, what services do they offer? I have been told by some people who've had this happen to them that they will be alerted and they'll say, yep, there's a credit problem. Somebody's trying to get into your stuff. But as far as financial liability, that's when it gets weak.
Yeah, where it gets more difficult. The federal government is claiming that they will provide liability insurance, financial support. But again, you know, the proof is somewhat in the pudding in terms of what that actually encompasses once it happens. We hope it won't happen. But how far that money goes is an obvious concern. The pool is only so big. But also how they would divvy it out in terms of issues and challenges is a little hard to understand.
Okay, going to take a short break here. I'm talking with Jill Latoro. She's editor of the Federal Times. We'll be right back here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, talking with Jill Latoro. She is editor, brand new editor of the Federal Times, and congratulations to you again on that, Jill. How are you finding this beat? Because you came from a sort of a biz-oriented operation.
Oh, I love it. I've kind of hopped back and forth. I was over at Washington Business Journal prior to here, focusing on federal procurement, federal contracting, policy tied to federal procurement. And prior to that, I was a government executive. I'm keying a lot into cybersecurity, DHS, and that sort of thing. So it actually, I'd like to think, or I hope it served me well in terms of having the perspective of both sides, because obviously these days, especially, federal government is working in partnership with industry on everything. They have to. So I feel like it's provided me a little bit more scope in terms of the exposure that I've had. It's great being back writing for the federal workforce. I enjoy that. There's so many fascinating topics to hop into. I happen to start right as this breach was emerging. So
yeah, well,
I began at when one of the biggest government stories, in years, is when I kicked off my tenure. So that made it even more interesting.
It's like World War II going to R&R, and it turns out it's the Battle of the Bulge down the road. But that's good. It'll make or break you, and I suspect
it'll make you.
You know, it's interesting. I've had people say, how can you stand to write about the government for these many years? And they think it's all a matter of pay and benefits. But while that's critical, Pay and benefits are critical, and they can often be dull, but they're still, this is money. This is money to make. But there's so many other issues, and people like us run across people in the intelligence community, and we run across people with law enforcement and get into situations like this where we're following one of the biggest detective stories, true detective stories that have hit this country.
Oh, yeah. It's fascinating, and you're right. It's such a breadth of topics in terms of the personnel issues and workforce issues, which are so important and very distinctive to the federal government in terms of what they're dealing with. But these days, government, I mean, the way technology is getting incorporated and the sensitivity of data and information as that technology gets incorporated, I mean, the topics just run the gamut. And then you talk about procurement and where the money goes and how the money's getting there. And that, you know, anytime you tie federal funds and money kind of leaving government and heading into the hands of business, it also gets interesting.
A couple of war stories. Coming back from vacation a year ago, and my grandson was sitting with the window on the flight, and I had the aisle seat because of my long legs, and there was a nice woman sitting in between us, and she was talking with my grandson mostly, and then she turned to me, and we started chatting, and she said she worked for NASA, and I said, "That's got to be a most fascinating place to work," and she said, "Well, not so much my job." But she said, my husband, and he happened to be sitting behind me for some reason, but she said her husband was involved in a project, and they were tracking, and I always get the term wrong, an asteroid, a meteor, but they were tracking a large body that's going to be close to Earth in a couple of years, and that's his project. And she said, she'd mentioned something, and then she'd lean back and ask him, and he'd tell her this, that, and the other. And I'm probably going to mess this up, but my recollection is she said that the Russians think it's going to come very, very close, maybe dangerously close, maybe wham close. The Americans are saying it will come between the Earth and the Moon, which is 234,000 miles, and that's close enough for me, for a meteor, an asteroid. But it was just interesting that this is what they're doing. And when we got off the plane, we shook hands, and I gave her my card, and she pointed to her husband, and she said, if you ever see his face on the front page of the Washington Post, you're toast.
Yeah.
You know, because he's running this project. And then just the other day, watching TV and looking at the Pluto crew.
Yeah.
As this thing whizzed by there. And, I mean, these people have been on this 9, 10, 11 years. They've aged into it. And looking at their faces and the satisfaction they must have, I can't conceive of it.
Oh, I can't either. I have a 5-year-old son, and he's got a fascination with space and a knowledge that surpasses mine in a lot of ways. And it's true. I come back after, you know, writing about or hearing about some of these, you know, fascinating projects that are going on, and it's just, you see his eyes light up, and you kind of realize just, it puts into perspective all of the interesting work that's happening around us, without a question.
Well, I got to talk to, along with some other people, and his name was Neil something, I forget now, but he was the chief meteorologist for the U.S. at the time, and he was talking about some of the problems they had, and I remember this distinctly happening, that there were a hurricane had formed in the South Atlantic, and they had a briefing, and they put it out, and they said, this is the largest hurricane that's formed in the South Atlantic since we've been keeping records. And he said everybody, all of the reporters, bright left the room, went out and said, monster storm to devour East Coast. You know, the headlines were all over the place.
Oh, yeah.
And he didn't understand how the media worked, and they didn't understand how science worked. But the first place, the largest hurricanes don't form in that part of the Atlantic. So he was qualifying it right there. And then he said, since we've been keeping a certain kind of record on a certain kind of radar, which had only been about 11 years. So he said nothing about a monster storm.
Yeah.
But the media interpreted it that way. They broadcast it. We bolted down the hatches. And I remember kissing my kids goodbye as I went to work that morning. And nothing happened. And then the media ridiculed the Weather Service for getting it wrong when they hadn't gotten it wrong.
No, yeah. It's unfortunate how often that happens, right?
Yeah, well, you run into it, and it's part of the game.
It is.
Jill, in your travels looking at this current, the OPM hack. I call it the hack of 2015, although I guess it took place last year. Did you get any tie-in with the hack of the thrift savings plan a couple of years back?
You know, all I am getting is, in terms of even talking to the sources, is that there is the potential that this is all filtering into the same bucket. You know, I don't know whether anybody knows for sure, but in terms of the goals, in terms of what is being the information is being used for. But beyond that, I haven't much. The risks, obviously, are similar and overlap. And I mean, that's true across the board, and the hacks we don't even know about, which there certainly are more of them. But that's pretty much all I've heard.
Well, you know, it shows you what a big, big deal this OPM hack is with the 21, 22 million people, and which could be is almost bound to be somebody you and I know.
Oh, yeah.
Or maybe us if we applied for a government job. There was a hack of the Postal Service last year.
Yeah.
Apparently independent of this. Mm-hmm. And the numbers on that are staggering. The Inspector General's report is out this week, and they made it available. But the numbers are staggering in that.
It's, I mean, I don't know about you, but I've had minor, thankfully, but my own information taken. We've had to change credit cards numerous occasions because folks have opened ones in our name. And
really?
Yeah, and it's thankfully we have banks that kind of track it and alert us, and then we change the number, and then it ends up happening again. I think it's happened at least three times. And you know, in talking to the security folks, they said, I mean, it's the odds are high, extremely high, that pretty much everybody has had their information taken, whether it's been used or not used, whether you're in government or outside of government, that it's been taken and someone has access to it. So, I mean, it's just we're too online and digital at this point for that not to happen. It's I mean, folks can get into the systems and our information is there.
One of my sons went to the Dominican Republic 2 years ago, and they were having lunch somewhere, Santo Domingo or one of the cities. And as he was having lunch, somebody was buying stuff from the credit card he was using. They were buying stuff at a Walmart in Atlanta, Georgia.
Yeah, that's similar to what happened to us. We suddenly were getting charges in states that were across the country from each other, which thankfully our bank noticed. But yeah, it's amazing, and it's a little bit sad that we're in a state that that isn't noticed, and we don't track, you know, in terms of the use of credit cards. You would think there'd be more security in place in terms of who can use them and when, but it is. It's pervasive.
Well, I have a friend who teases me about being low-tech or no-tech, and he, of course, does online banking and thinks that people like me are Neanderthals, and yet the other day some of the banks were cracked, and some of that information, that bill-paying information. What I do with if it's anything significant, I've got a cashier's check. And it's payable to whoever it's payable to.
It's
lost, you know, if it's lost, you can redeem it, which happened to me recently.
Yeah.
But there's no other than my signature on it, and I could write Mickey Mouse on it. It's a cashier's check.
But right.
Maybe we need to go back to the low tech.
Well, it's funny, and then we talk about social media. Just recently, I had someone in my family whose entire Facebook profile was replicated, picture and everything. And then the person started reaching out to her contacts, befriending them, and the contacts saw her picture, saw her name, thought, oh, she must have just dropped me accidentally, and were accepting, and they were building up their contacts of folks, and then starting to ask personal questions and so forth. So that social engineering, that it's amazing, the tactics that folks take.
Hey, I want to get into that. That fascinates me, but we need to take a short break here. We'll be right back here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. Hi, Mike Causey back here. I'm talking with Jill Otero. She is the editor of the Federal Times, a new editor, and having come from a interesting and varied background in the federal community, and we're talking about things. Jill, I have on my wall a letter or a notice that Tammy Flanagan, the benefits expert who writes for Government Executive, among other things, but Tammy handed this to me one time, and it's from the Department of the Air Force to all civilian employees, and I wish I'd brought it into the studio with me, but it says the following actions are about to be taken by Congress. As soon as they become law, we will tell you how they apply to you. When we get the OPM regulations, we'll keep you posted. But this was just a hands-on alert. And it said they're going to change the high three computation back to the high five. You know, it was high five for years.
Yeah.
They changed it to high three. It made people's annuities larger, then they're going to change it back to the high five. They're going to do, and it was this laundry list of things that they're going to do, the change CPI to give people smaller cost of living adjustments in the future, just this litany of things. And you look at the date, and it's August 1982. Yeah, so nothing new under the sun on the federal
government work slowly, we hear, right?
Right, yeah. And again, you forget, but once this is going through Congress, they make a lot of noise, but they rarely do anything, anything detrimental. Now, that said, they are pushing, they being the Congress, are pushing something now, I think is part of the Highway Trust Act, but they would lower the interest rate on the G Fund. And, of course, the G Fund is the Treasury Securities component of the Federal Thrift Savings Plan, Uncle Sam's 401k program.
Mm-hmm.
And something like 92% of the people who have money in the Thrift Savings Plan have something in the G Fund. And a huge number, maybe 49%, maybe more than that, have everything in the G Fund.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not there to make a lot of money. I think it's paying 2% interest right now, but they're there for the safety of it. You know, it's Treasury securities, it's as solid as the Rock of Gibraltar, et cetera.
Sure.
But if it were devalued that way and that the, quote, savings from that applied to the Highway Trust Fund, that would make the G Fund a very unattractive option except for pure safety alone, but there would be no growth in it. Have you been tracking that?
You know, I have not personally since I came on board.
Mm-hmm.
Have not. I mean, it's a financial situation that it's specific to the federal government, but it's a similar scenario that folks are facing in and outside of government in terms of their investments right now. The difference being that it's unusual for federal government to be influenced by maneuvers that have to do with Congress. So we certainly will be, and we'll be tracking it. I haven't spoken to anybody yet about it.
Well, I know the situation. A lot of federal workers and a lot of retirees are angry and upset that whenever you hit a debt ceiling problem, that they, quote, borrow money
mm-hmm.
from the TSP.
Yeah.
And it's a paper exercise, and that we've been assured by all officials that nobody loses a nickel. It's just a paper exercise. But it worries people that the government is borrowing from their retirement nest egg, even if it's just for a brief period of time and even if no harm is done.
Well, you know, it reminds me of what you hear a lot about folks complaining with pensions and public companies, because certainly public companies and publicly traded companies maneuver pension funds like crazy in terms of helping, trying to improve their bottom line and so forth. And, you know, it's very similar, and they will argue this has nothing to do with the amount of money available to our employees. But it's, you know, there's a degree of fear in terms of playing with money that folks intend to live on once they're done working. It just doesn't seem like that should factor into anything along those lines, but it does.
Well, Jill, you've had a lot of experience covering the business side and the financial side of government and things like that. It looks to me as if, you know, unless the government implodes, that in 5-10 years, the government is, if not now, is going to be the employer of choice simply because of the steadiness of government employment.
Mm-hmm.
Even during the Great Recession, there were no layoffs in government.
Right.
There was a pay freeze, but there were no layoffs. And I know at that same time, I personally know four people who took pay cuts ranging from 5% to 25%. During the during the recession, and several companies dropped 401k plans. All of the companies that I'm familiar with, every one of them dropped the employer match.
Yep.
And even some of the big investment houses that handle 401k, they dropped the match for their employees.
Yeah.
And yet the government continues to match 5%. It continues to offer guaranteed retirement for life plus health insurance into retirement, irrespective of the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare.
Yeah.
And do you see this, the government is becoming the place to work?
You know, it's funny. It's always, for a long time, it was you went to government for job security. You went to government for really good benefits. You went to private sector for higher salaries.
Right.
And it is starting to change. There's pockets on the private side, technology in particular, even government contracting, where that's still true to some degree. But those salaries are not making the gains in private sector like they once were. So that draw is going down. And while federal government has also had its challenges in terms of, you know, pay raises, whether they were going to happen, whether they're not going to happen, whether they were enough, that's always an ongoing debate. But in terms of job security, in terms of benefits, they are holding steady more so than private sector. Now, there's also, you have to consider on the private sector, there was a very strange bubble that happened there for a while where the benefits were a little ridiculous to some degree. So there's some normalizing that was happening in certain industries that probably needed to happen. But yeah, it definitely has taken a hit. And giving a bit of a reality check, I think, to the public.
So many of the jobs that are being created in the private sector are very low-wage service jobs.
Mm-hmm.
They're not like the old days. It's interesting, our producer, Lauren Larson, just back from visiting, she was in the West Coast, but she was in Silicon Valley, and she said, you know, that's the land of milk and honey. Everybody's happy. There are companies that you have free food and you can set your hours, but they demand excellence. You know,
yeah.
It's a meritocracy. And the downside of that is, if you had a small apartment in that part of the, in San Jose, will run $5,000 a month.
Yes, so, I was just going to say that the one downside I've heard is if you want to work for the company, that's great, but that the expenses tied to it are phenomenal.
Yeah, and you're looking at a very long commute. It's like these people who work in resort cities like Vail and Sundance, they can't afford to live in the town where they work.
No, yeah, it is. It's amazing. That used to be New York City to some degree, and it still is. But Silicon Valley has blown up to, you know, just it's the balance is off. And for a lot of what Silicon Valley was built on was, of course, startups. And they don't necessarily start off with a huge amount of funds.
Yeah.
And these are the companies that government is trying to tap, especially now. So how,
whether or
not they'll be able to see the growth that they need to experience in a place like Silicon Valley, it'll be interesting to watch.
Jill, I don't know about you, but I'm not going to quit my daytime job.
No.
Jill,
however, who knew that journalism would be the most solid profession?
That's right. It's absolutely frightening. Jill Latorre, thank you so much for being with us. We'll get you back on the show here, and we'll keep tracking this thing. I hope you learned something today, folks. This is a horrible but interesting and vital subject. And anyhow, we'll see you next week at 10 o'clock. Have a good week.